So, Max, it's been a while since we did anything with Barely Human.
It's been
kind of interesting times. Since that time, we got an email.
We'll be playing live in a little bit, but right now we're going to answer another email question.
All right, email.
We got two variants in an email.
Yeah. Yeah, what was the... want to explain what the email was? Fan mail?
Post-series, I got a few emails from, you know, fans and stuff correcting errors in various episodes. But this was a bigger one. Was one of the artists of one of the bands covered. Subject title, Error-Filled Podcast, I believe.
Kind of came out of nowhere as well, or seemingly came out of nowhere. I think it came... So I received it on the 15th of October last year. And when was the last episode? It was a while before that.
April 2020, so it's, you know, 18 months-ish.
Yeah.
So it's a long time since we were done. And I think both of us were just like, oh, well, that was a project of the past. You know, every mistake we've made has, you know, just deal with it and move on. But this was a bit of a bigger email. It was a lot of good points made about my research approach.
Yeah, and it's funny because it goes to show that obviously you know if you're creating something that that's going to go out into the world, once you create it and put it out there, it's kind of up to the world or other people to kind of digest it or reinterpret it. And I hadn't forgotten about the project. I mean, it's one of my favorite projects that I've probably ever done. It was a lot of fun. And I still listen to the episodes pretty regularly, but when I got this email, I think I was at the library doing some work, and it didn't seem real at first. It was like, Clark Blacker, I know that name. Oh. Oh.
Yeah. I thought it was a prank.
I did too. Yeah. So I thought maybe I could read some of Clark's first email.
Yeah.
It's because it's kind of funny now, and...
Now that we've talked to him and discussed everything,
yeah,
and got everything up above board, I feel much better about it. And, obviously, I think I read it because I couldn't sleep, so I think he forwarded it to me, and you know, trying not to look at my phone, and 3 o'clock in the morning, I was just like, oh no.
Yeah, well, that's brutal that you were reading it at 3 a.m. But so this is the email that I received. No introduction, just goes right into it. Just stick the knife in. So Clark says, I only discovered your podcast today and was disturbed when I listened to it, which is awesome, because that's kind of, in some way, it's kind of like what we were going for.
direction, yeah.
As the founder of Stickmen with Ray Guns, I'm sorry, but I found your podcast to be biased, poorly researched, and blatantly sensationalistic. In fact, I can't figure out where you got so much misinformation. You clearly wanted to talk about the seedier side of any situation, truth be damned. I can only assume from this that you're too lazy to do decent research. There were numerous factual errors in the section concerning Stickmen with Ray Guns that could have been prevented if you had bothered to stop by our website. Which we did, right? Or you did, Max.
Yeah. But, you know, you can read the thing and still get it wrong somehow, it seems. I don't know how.
Well, he goes on to point out a couple of things, which are like, you know, I guess there were some factual errors, but his response to it, and he goes into this, we'll go into it in the interview. His response, personally, I still feel had more to do with him dealing with the legacy of this band than it did actually our factual errors.
And some of the factual errors are like getting band members' names wrong, which are sort of just like such research 101 mistakes that I don't know how I did it other than just being too overwhelmed and too stressed and trying to do write too many things at the same time and just like dropping the Stickmen with Ray Guns story in and trying to get it, you know, on the paper and record it as quick as I could so I can move on to the next episode, blah blah blah. But you know, it's really like such a good email to get because now it's kind of every time I write a name down,
yeah,
I'm like putting asterisks on it and I'm highlighting it and I'm going back and I'm checking everything. I don't have any journalistic training, so, but I'm sure that's the first thing you learn at school, right?
Yeah, well, and this is where I failed you, because I have some journalistic training, and as the producer, you know, should have gone through. I've even got a checklist of key things to look for from a journalistic standpoint. It's names, dates, places. Yeah, you know. And yeah, we were just we were under the pump, really, and trying to push it out as quickly as possible. So I think there's a lesson there of going slow, particularly in a medium like this, when, you know, we had, any deadlines that we had were largely self-imposed. To a degree.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, one of the things that he points out is that we said in the episode that Mark Ridlin was the bassist, and Mark Ridlin was actually only temporarily on bass. Yeah.
Yeah, and Scott Elam was the drummer. I think I said Mark Ridlin was the drummer. But I mean, I guess that's, you know, that's important in terms of, like, if any of my bands that I've played in over the years ever got a podcast episode 30 years time, which almost certainly won't happen.
Might do.
Or some metaverse reconstruction version thereof. yeah, I mean, it would be a bummer if one of my friends was miscredited.
Yeah.
So I guess that's one thing. And then there's other stuff that Clark brought up about. Some of it is like, I guess one thing I wanted to say, sticking with Raygun's story, is it hasn't been written down anywhere in much detail, so it's sort of had to be reconstructed from interviews, and a lot of those interviews were done with, like, members of the Butthole Surfers, who are also very sensationalistic in the way they describe the events. And some of the events are like, Bobby Sox putting a microphone in his butt hole. and I think in the show it said, like, that happened first, and then the Butthole Surfers had to go on. But, I mean, Clark corrected it, was actually the other way around. But
yeah.
So all that sort of stuff, it's such a chaotic story that, I guess we sort of focused on the chaos of the band, because that was the interesting part, and the extreme aspects, what the band sound like, and what sort of what they represented in early 80s Texas, late 70s Texas. I'm making errors again. Yeah. So, yeah. And then there's other stuff that we could have done a lot better too, which we talked to Clark about.
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, once we got through the initial shock of receiving this kind of scary email, felt like we had been eviscerated, you know, in the first email. Once we got through that and we responded to him, in some ways, you know, it was amazing that, in all ways, it was amazing that we got to speak directly to the source, particularly for a band that, as you say, has such a kind of piecemeal historical record. It's nice to be able to speak directly to the source, and not only does he have the names and dates, but he also has the conceptualization of the band, which is hard to find.
Yeah, or even, like, you know, you can, I guess with writing stuff like this, it was such a learning process. And it's, you know, you can get an idea from what people have said or sort of what's on record, but kind of connecting the dots is a real thrilling experience. For me as a writer, it's really fun to try and get to the bottom of what someone's doing. And then, I think, like, the issue then is, like, with interpretation, I'm sure this is just, like, criticism in general, but, you know, going through all that and rewriting that story is more enjoyable than getting the facts right. So, that always has to be the thing. And that's the last line of Clark's first email, which, I think among all the errors, like, that, this was the one which stuck with me the most, was, you made a judgment about us without knowing or apparently caring about the facts, because it gave you an opportunity to moralize and sit in judgment with impunity. And,
oof.
It's very strong and very true. Even though, like, you know, I can be hard on myself or gentle to myself, but, you know, so much of that process of that series, it was just making judgments. And, in the later emails, like Clark was saying things like, you know, you could have just emailed me. Like, my email address is on the website, dickmanwithrayguns.com. Like, it's right there.
Yeah.
And I think, like, when we caught up, when it was safer to catch up at pubs, we talked about it. But
yeah,
so much of the research process for me was to, I really wanted to lean just on the archive, just on what's in zines and just what's on the internet and just what's in books, and not go to primary sources, because I couldn't do that with, say, Lucille Bogan or Black Randy or Polystyrene or G.G. Allen or Bobby Socks of Stickman and Three Guns. Like, I couldn't ask them questions, so I wanted everyone to get the same treatment, even though, you know, members of Low Life lived around the corner from me at the time. you know, I wanted everyone to be treated, though, so whatever's in print is there, and that's what we got to deal with, and that's why the series, that was kind of the philosophy of the series. And then getting this email, it's like, I should just email Clark Black over the Stickman with Ray Guns.
Yeah, but I mean, as you say, yeah, giving everyone the treatment, or having a kind of taking an equal approach across the whole series was, whether it was good or not, it was the decision that we made at the time. And going back to joining the dots, it was a real thrill to see how you had connected the dots from, you know, Lucille Bogan in the 30s to Low Life in the 2010s. It was a fun journey, and I guess I would just say that we didn't claim from the very beginning to be entirely factual.
Yeah.
There was a bit of editorializing in there, and I think that was pretty obvious, but I do still feel bad that Clark's critique in particular was that we had focused on the kind of what he considers the sensationalistic side of their story. And fair enough, I mean, it is compelling to talk about Bobby Socks because he was just an absolute madman, but of course there were other people involved, and Bob Clark took it really seriously,
and, as he should. And, you know, I mean it's not that I didn't take it seriously, but I think one of Clark's great points in the interview was that or maybe less in the interview, maybe it was in the emails, or just on our own reflections, it's all people. You know, like, writing all these stories, rewriting these stories, and kind of saying this is what person XYZ was doing, as though it's fiction, you know, to do a compelling piece of audio work, while just glossing over people's real feelings, the impacts they had. And, you know, I was so concerned and focused on getting the full story done in 10 minutes. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, you know how you just gloss over one person's name on the way through and choose? That's a whole human being with a whole life that then gets plugged into this retrospective little piece of audio. And, you know, Stickman with Ray Guns in particular, or any of these bands really, they're associated with some interesting things, or some things that they may not want to be associated with.
Yeah.
It's that question of legacy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think there's also a limitation of the medium as well. Always good to remember that it's human lives. But podcasting is a hilarious medium. And it's limited. And I've heard people like the Cocaine and Rhinestones podcast, fantastic podcast, but like the amount of detail that he goes into, it's like not everybody's up for that, and it is really intense, and we weren't exactly trying to do that.
No, definitely not. I think like some of our early conversations were about that. It was like, let's do two band stories, 10 minutes each, with an introduction to the time and a middle point that sort of connects the two, and glue it all together, and we'll close it out neatly at the end, and all episodes will be less than 40 minutes. That's that was really fun. I think that's what is a positive of the series, but boy, did we gloss over something.
So we've learned that like Soylent Green, barely him and his people. And
you gotta tell him Silent Green is people.
And that Clark is a real person, and he's a lovely man. We really enjoyed having a chat with him. So thank you to Clark for taking the time. There was some back and forth about it, but we lined up a time that was good for both Sydney, Australia, and Fort Myers, Florida, to have a chat. And Clark was like very generous with his time. So, yeah, maybe we should get into it. Should we get into the interview?
Yeah.
All right, let's have a listen. There he
is. How is everybody? Jason and Max.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing okay. How are you guys today?
Yeah, good.
We're pretty good. It's morning here, so we're drinking our coffee.
Yeah, well, you're in my future. So, let's go for it.
So to start, Clark, I think the first thing I wanted to do was to help rectify the errors that are sort of made in telling the band's story, and just start off with asking you how you would tell the story of Sigon Tre Guns. Like, how would you reintroduce the band to like listeners of the show?
If you're interested in to know, you know, how it got started, it's pretty straightforward. I was playing in a band called Bag of Wire, which I had formed recently with two members of the Nerve Breakers. The Nerve Breakers had a split, and lead guitar player and bass player came to me, and together, and myself and a couple other people, create a band called Bag of Wire. And Bag of Wire was a sort of blatantly guitar-oriented dance band. Basically, we did was we picked all the guitar-based material that we loved, and it was significant. We played Beefheart, we played the Troggs, we played, the Supremes. I mean, we played all sorts of different kinds of things, just loud. in a way, kind of like, sort of like some of the Stone stuff. In a sense, R&B stuff. But we were just there and to be a dance band. It got real, real popular, real sudden. Three of the five of us were going through divorces at the time. And the lead guitar player, Mike, from the Nerve Breakers, had just split from the Nerve Breakers, a band that he'd been playing in for probably better than 10 years in one version or another, and most of the time with another guitar player. And so after a couple of months of playing, and we were having a lot of success, he kind of went, I hate to do this, but I don't really want to share the stage with another guitar player for a while. And so I just kind of got eased out. And at one of our shows in, I'm going to say early January 81, Bobby Sox approached me after a Bag of Wire show and said, "Oh, hey man, I really want to start a band with you." I don't think I'd ever exchanged more than a hello with Bobby before. We didn't exactly overlap directly in our day-to-day stuff. But I'd been aware of him for a long time. And so after the show, Bobby, you know, as he asked me to do this, he'd taken one of his tracts and he used to hand Xerox, paste front to back, fold and staple, and take around to record stores back in the 70s and, you know, like ask them to sell them for a quarter or something like that. And they were called the Flaming Gavel, and they were insane tracts, just insane cut and paste, some of it writing, some of it cartoons, just the most insane stuff you'd ever seen. But anyways, after I got eased out of Bag of Wire, I went, well, you know, what the hell? And so I just started telling people, said, hey, if you run into the Sox, tell them I'd like to talk to him. And so out of the blue, one day he shows up at my back door. So, you know, I said, well, you know, let's try to do something. And he thought that was cool. And he was a very fascinating character. I had never had the opportunity to spend any time with him. And he was clearly what you would say, not normal. And I don't know exactly how you would describe it, because he didn't seem to exist in the sort of the same interpersonal space that like most two people do if they're sitting there talking. There was a lot of Bobby going on in his head all the time that sort of seemed to color everything else. And but he was oddly eloquent and incredibly funny, made fun of himself a lot. He joked around, particularly on stage. He acted the fool quite a lot. I found him to be funny. So I said, well, look, I've got my friend Scott, who's a drummer, and let's try what we can do. We got together and, you know, it became instantly obvious that Bobby had something special, but it wasn't a regular thing. You had to kind of, you couldn't approach it like you would say, oh, let's start a punk band or let's start a hard rock band. You had to go, okay, what can this guy do? What he could do was write and be Bobby in front of people. And so we set about trying to find a bass player. Vicky's sister, Valerie, came and played once. She'd played with him before. It wasn't going to be right. And we ended up with a friend named Mark Ridlin sitting in, because he had another band that he was a major part of, but he sat in till we could find somebody. And then, you know, one day after maybe 3 months or so after a show at Metamorphosis, Bobby walks up with this young guy and says, hey, this is Bob Beeman. He's our new bass player. And I was like, okay, cool. and Bobby was fantastic. Bobby, you know, a lot of people would go, oh, he's not much of a bass player, but Bobby created the most truly unbelievable sounds out of his bass sometimes.
It's a bass player, and his records are unbelievable.
When the, you know, the Butthole Surfers had been trying to get us to get off our asses for a really long time, and had been trying to do things for us. And finally, they ended up through King and Emperor Jones just saying, here, we're going to, let's put this out. But part of the deal was they wanted to fill up the CD to maximum time. And so a lot of stuff that I wouldn't, that wasn't on the original version was on the commercial version of Suffer on Emperor Jones. And it was the stuff that I considered to be second level at best, mostly. And the reason for that is we were not very successful in the studio. Well, we only went into the studio. We only went into studio three times. The second time was the worst. The one where the, or maybe it was the last one. That might have been in sequence in time. Might have been the last one. The one where Baby Now and you know, a couple other things. There's a version of I'll Kill Mother and stuff like that. They were a complete and utter failure in the studio. It was largely my fault. I didn't know how to communicate what I wanted things to sound like, and things went entirely too far in this kind of thin and crappy sound, and the levels weren't very good. So Bobby, the Sox, had a song that he had performed in his earlier band called the Teenage Queers, and I'd never heard it. I think Beeman might have heard it, but I'd never heard it. But he recited the lyrics in his way that he did, because he kind of chanted lyrics. That was Bobby's thing. And songs started out of him chanting phrases, and he worked stuff out often while he was working. He often worked as a fry cook. He would work stuff out as he was working. And so we went, okay, well, we wrote some music. And Gibby Haynes of the Surfers was engineer. And so we had a 16 track. And so in about 3 hours, we recorded it, I think I mixed in a total of 3 guitar solos, positioned differently and doing different stuff over it, and pretty much got it done and mixed and all ready to go. And we were, you know, we left, and I thought everything was fine. And then when the record came out, they cut off the spoken word intro to the song, and had just turned on the echo in their when they were making the master, to where you couldn't understand the words at all. And but Gibby, ever our friend, stole the half track master. and David, who was he worked at the studio, so he stole the half track master,
and still has it.
No, we have it. He gave it to us. So it's, we had to cut back on the spoken word intro. It had gotten cut off. We had to put it back on.
In the beginning, the Lord created the earth and the seas. But on the seventh day, God rested his prick in Satan's butt. We'll be right back.
But that's the one that you hear on the Suffer CD. That is the one. And at the very tail end of it, you'll hear this somebody cackling really loud. That's Giddy laughing. Because that song was so, that song was so loud.
I'm going to look
always,
for that.
Always one of my favorite songs. It's Go for Extreme, you know.
So that's the only track you recorded that you're happy, completely happy with.
Yeah. The other stuff now, I mean, we did live shows that were really good, that some of them that got recorded on tape, and thank heavens they've finally been the two ones that really we had enough quality to work with. Have been released now. The Property of Jesus Christ live album and A Thousand Lives to Die album.
Amazing sound.
We've gone off on a tangent, I think. You were asking how we started the band. That's it. Well, basically, I started to tell you how we started the band. But what had become evident to me, the thing I didn't say, was what had become evident to me during the time that we were working with Mark Ridlon before Bobby came in, was there was only one way this band could go. It had to go all in, full out crazy. It, you know, not in a showbiz way, but it had to be as aggressive and as out of control in every way that you could think of as his lyrics were.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. And described it.
Anything else was not enough.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a special package once it all comes together. I've seen you describe it as intentionally self-destructive as an approach. And you've also spoken a bit about like the philosophy of the band too, which I guess is all part of that, just the as a package.
It's hard to say that the band had a philosophy. I make jokes about the stick man character. I just talk about the irrationality of it. Scott, the drummer, and myself would have a lot of philosophical discussions about the band that didn't necessarily reflect at all times the feelings of other people. It was a bit different. As far as we were concerned, we were busy exploring the sort of the limits of just irrational anger, you know, just no supporting ideas, you know, there's nothing about any of it could you say was okay. So we know that exists in the world, and it seemed like that's just not something that anybody spent much time fiddling with. And so with Bobby's, this isn't something you could talk about with Bobby because Bobby would go, "What do you mean irrational anger?"
Haven't you seen the world today?
As he conjures up the craziest scenes.
As he works at the fry cook, chanting.
Yeah.
But, that's amazing.
You know, it was better you do that than act them out in real life. As bad as Bobby was at times, he didn't really act out that stuff in real life. It was so over the top that only the most lunatic of people could ever believe anything that we had to say. And, yeah, and we had no, yeah, we had no problem completely contradicting ourselves in the next song. Mm-hmm. You know? Because we had no real philosophy. We were sort of just the expression of irrational anger, mostly.
So how did people respond to that at the time? Because the circumstances, well, the early 80s in Texas.
I think, to be honest, at least probably 75% of it was the unpredictable show. And I don't mean it in quite the tabloidy way, but our shows were really, really unpredictable and really uneven, I would say. You know, we could suck for half a set and sound terrific for half a set. We could come out and, we could come out and fall flat on our faces for two songs and then destroy the audience. But, there were various causes for that. And I couldn't exactly explain it, but we didn't really care. And as Bob Beeman will often point out, we weren't there to entertain the audience. The audience was there to entertain us. So in a way, we were intentionally being provocative, but not in kind of the typical way that you would do it. And which is why there are cheap ways to do it. And then there, there are ways that actually scare people. You know, and I I'll be honest with you. I full on wanted the band to terrify the audience. I know my own sister walked out in tears. So.
Wow.
We wanted to put on good shows. We put on a lot of very uneven shows because we were uneven individuals. But the conditions were strange. But we had a lot of fun. And things like the more what I would say tabloid kind of incidents, like the microphone up the butt thing. Those were not really common events, and I never would allow, nothing was ever pre-planned, and I never allowed anything to happen more than once. If something happened, I was like, don't do that again. And I will tell you that that did happen once, and I had threatened to leave. Mm-hmm. Bobby was married for a couple of years in the late 80s. He got married in, I guess, probably 87 to a girl named Sandy. And she ended up performing oral sex on stage once. And I was pretty bugged about it, but I didn't say anything. So it happened again a few weeks later. And I told him afterwards that I was gone if it ever happened again. So because then it became about that. And that's the one thing that we never set out to do, was to have anything be about that, about something other than the band and the music.
Yeah.
So if anything took away from that aspect of it, we discarded it. But mainly that whatever happened tended to be, and I'm sure the first time that happened, it was on a whim and just something that happened. But most of the other stuff that ever went on, just like the microphone incident, only happened one time. While we were out of town, and I felt so bad for the band that had to follow.
Yeah, they had to use that mic.
If you go back, if you go to our website and you go look at that picture again, look over on the far left, you'll see a very young Gibby Haynes standing there laughing his head off. He's like the first or second person on the left-hand side of the picture.
Yeah. taking notes.
They had played right before us, and I don't know what possessed Bobby to do that, but that's the only time that ever happened.
Yeah, it's pure spectacle.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, or Max, I don't know if you want to handle that, but the part of one of the main reasons why we're having this conversation is your response to the episode, and it seems to me that it's, you know, part of it has to do with, correcting the history as it has been told and kind of dealing with the legacy of the band and of Bobby's antics. And as you said, you felt sometimes that kind of gets in the way of the story of the band as the band is told. Do you want to kind of address that?
Yeah. And I have to say that it's through no fault of anybody but ourselves, but a lot of people didn't understand the band very well and don't today understand it. I've tried to, when I write stuff about it, I've tried to be as honest as I can be about it from the perspective that I have. Everybody's experience in it was a bit different. Everybody's vision of it is a bit different. But I felt like, and I can say at the time that Scott felt like it too, because he was very, very active in discussing the philosophy, or what he perceived to be the philosophy of the band, and that it was actually a serious, in a way, thing to explore, a valid emotion or perspective to explore. Love, and I mean, all sorts of other things that are explored all the time. But, you know, going out and, you know, let's go for the crazy with someone who visits it, you know, on some levels, more or less, depending on how you see it. it gives you a fascinating look into a way of thinking that I couldn't fathom, as a matter of fact. I mean, Bobby's lyrics, when you read them, they're fascinating and complicated. Not every single thing, but the best of the work is what I would call profound. You know, I think that particularly What Am I is a pretty spectacular piece lyrically, you know, and you know, just the idea of speaking as the force of life, all the good and the bad and everything, that's a hell of a perspective. That's not something that tends to come up very often in rock songs or something. So, and Grave City is just a powerful piece of writing, you know, and we did the best possible job we could with that song. I think there's real power in his lyrics, and there's real powerful imagery in his crazy stuff, you know, and the stuff that you go, well, obviously, no, you can't do that. You know, or you have to be nuts to say something like that. But if there's power in the writing, and there's power in the delivery, it is without a doubt the greatest song I think that we ever did. It's, you know, I think One of Mine is better lyrically, but Grave City is just the perfect Stiffman with Ray Gunn song. Wasn't that I hated the audience or anything like that. I just wanted, we were there to sow chaos and a different kind of way. Nihilistic, maybe. I'm not sure exactly that be the right way to put it. But we were pretty much against everything. and were proud of it and said, sure, that's irrational. You know. But it wasn't that we were all that way as individuals. You know, everybody had their own reasons for being there. And I considered it to be an artistic endeavor and probably the single most successful artistic thing that I've ever done. And, you know, I wish I'd been anywhere close to as successful in painting as I was with Stickman as far as my goal. You know, we had no intention of being popular or face art.
It's kind of impossible to get fame when you sound so ugly, you know, the music's
I don't think of it as so much as ugly as I always think of it as kind of like a threshing machine to the face. What I can say about what I did and what I think the band in some way was doing was letting your id kind of take over temporarily. And it causes some interaction problems because I would tell you that any one of us was the nicest people, or if you met Bobby on the right day, you'd think he was the nicest guy you ever met. But all of us were nice and very reasonable people. But when you got the four of us together as the band or backstage or something like that, we sort of just became more belligerent. We didn't look for trouble. We just were like, don't look at me. because we were constantly being harassed for being too loud, you know, and this, that, and the other thing, you know, and just lots of shit going on. And the worst thing you could do is tell us to turn down, because Demon can always get louder.
No, but there's something that stuck with me that you said in one of your emails about people looking back at the band and kind of glossing over lyrics or forgetting to talk about it or focusing on antics or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something I've thought a lot about as like a punk music fan too. My favorite lyrics are, you know, by Stickman with Ray Guns or Flipper or someone like that, where you can't really hear them. And like a casual listen, you might hear it. But, you know, yeah, if What Am I was a Merle Haggard song or something, it'd be one of his greatest. You know, do you think it's like a genre thing that it has to be delivered in this way, but then you kind of, it cheapens lyrics in some sense?
I don't know. I mean, if you're asking about whether it bothers me that people gloss over the lyrics or miss them, it does. That's why I try to make what I can available. One of the messages, and I hope I'm answering your question, I'm not sure that I am.
Oh, that's fine. Exactly. Yeah.
But yes. If I don't, hit me again with it. But, I try to make it as easy as possible if I can for people to have some idea that, you know, there was thought going into this, as opposed to just ranting or, you know, the whole thing. And sort of everything about what I do, whether I do it very well or not, could be questioned. But everything about what I do about the band is trying to show that the band is more complicated than people think it is. And that many things, I mean, the thing you can take away from that is virtually any band that you look at, there's going to be things about them that are more complicated. And whether or not you think those things are worth pursuing, finding anything about, that's entirely personal about, you know, how you connect with something. You know, if you find our stuff powerful, then the more that you understand what was going on, I think the more you can appreciate the power of it. Which is why I constantly fight against the as I refer to it, Bobby becoming a cartoon character for people, that it just becomes this antics, you know, which is the G.G. Allen thing. Whenever that name comes up, I just go, no, I don't ever want to hear that again. There is no comparison. There's nothing. There was nothing that we did that was anything like him or in any way. We weren't even in the same thing. I don't really consider him a musician or a singer. He was just putting on a show. You know, that's all it was. And he didn't have anything he was doing. He didn't have anything to contribute. He was just being outrageous. That, you know, that is something you can do. He chose to do that. We chose to be more complicated than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's different universes, the two bands.
But it's been important to me that that part of it not get obscured by the show. That when the Bobby stuff starts to overwhelm things, I want people to back up, listen to the songs again, read some of the lyrics, think about this, think, just back up from that show for a minute and think about what's going on here, and that there was something happening. Other than just somebody getting up and acting outrageously in front of people, which you can line any bunch of musicians up behind somebody like that. And if you put on a crazy enough show, it doesn't matter what they do. They'd be playing Mary Had a Little Lamb for a week. I mean, if the show was good enough, you wouldn't care. But that wasn't it. Bobby was the central focus visually on stage, but, you know, neither one of myself or Beeman ever felt like we were less important to what was happening, you know. And, you know, I never gave way on anything, and neither did Bobby, you know, Beeman, I mean. It was kind of a unified front up at the front, and with Scott banging away in the back, you know, being you know, the drummer, that, you know, the extremely simple but kind of primitive kind of drumming he was using, you know, worked pretty good.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect package, truly.
Yeah.
One of the things that we haven't asked that I'm just kind of just purely interested in is what were you listening to at the time? You've mentioned, and I can't get it out of my head now, that an early influence on your stuff was the Troggs, and now I can only think about the bass line and Our Love Will Still Be There, and how that kind of, you know, but what were you listening to at the around that time that was an influence, aside from the drum?
Well, I always listened to a lot of Captain Beefheart. I was very, very interested in Public Image, particularly the second album. You know, I love the Ramones, but, you know, I mean, I didn't have a lot. I didn't have a lot of the current stuff. I was, you know, I came to this whole thing kind of late. As you know, when we started this band, I was 10 years older than most everybody that I had any contact with, at least 12 or 13 most of the time. You know, I was 30 going on 31, and you know, most everybody I knew is somewhere between 18 and 27 or something. Yeah. And so their experiences with things were really different, but that there's something that was very different about that time in history, musical history, that is different than the way it is now. And at that time, there young people were starting to realize there were no rules. And so bands were starting to get to be more experimental. They were going off in different directions. I know that in the Dallas area, the audiences would support rockabilly bands. They would support all sorts of things. It was all you had to do was present it in a reasonable way for young people. If it was good rock music, they liked it. And that's one of the reasons that Bag of Wire was very successful in its brief life, is that it was just an extension of what I discovered when I first ran into the Nerve Breakers in late 76 and realized that, here was the reason that I liked rock and roll in the first place. I'd kind of forgotten it. The 70s was a kind of a weird time for rock music, I think. And I'd gotten drug off by European jazz rock stuff that was not even really imported much over here. So I had kind of wandered away from mainstream rock, which it became arena rock all throughout the 70s and Boston and those kinds of horrible things. And so, you know, when I encountered the Nerve Breakers, it was like, holy crap, what fun. Back there complicated things. Yeah. Nerve Breakers is a good example of a band that has a drummer that is way better than anybody you probably ever will meet personally. Yeah. And he never lets you forget it. I only mean that if you listen to their music, you hear this drummer who can just run rings around everybody and does. He's always right there. He's, you know, he does what he needs to do, but the drumming for Nerve Breakers is extremely complicated. And, you know, Scott took the complete opposite approach, you know, for this band. It was all very straightforward and very simple. And, you know, towards the end, I was cutting down I was heading towards single chord songs, is where I was headed. So that, again, that reflects interests that I've got now. The simplification and the material that was written towards the end of the period of the band. I was headed in the direction of one chord songs. There's power in the delivery. When he performed, he was a hell of a character on stage. He kind of made fun of himself on stage. He would do weird dancing sometimes, and he was sort of this clown character on stage who was also at the same time screaming at you and yelling at you.
Yeah.
So you just
know exactly what... Strongman and the beaded lady.
He could flip directions really, you know, in a blink of an eye, and he was a genuinely interesting person on stage. And, I know the very first time I saw him, which was a couple or three years before, maybe when he was at a Robert Gordon show, and they had some kind of a dress like you're from the 50s contest, and he kind of dressed that way anyway, so he won the contest. That he was up on, they brought him up on stage, and it was like, here's Bobby Sox. I was like, oh, okay. And then later on, I go, that's that guy I saw. Then I saw him singing with the Scuds at DJ's, which was the first pub club in Dallas. And the Scuds were this crazy, crazy amateur band that they had, depending on what night you saw them, they had either two or three singers and all singing simultaneously. And often the time that I saw them, Bobby was the third one. And so our song, I'd Rather Throw Up Than Grow Up, is a Scud song.
All right.
And that's one that I always loved playing. And
Clark, is DJ's the where you were playing in that Dallas local news segment? Do you know the one?
No. Stickmen formed right after DJ's went down. I don't remember. We might have been at the Hot Club that night. That might be. I'd have to go back and look. I can't really recall. If it had a dressing room, it was probably the Hot Club.
It looked like a proper venue,
It's really interesting. Yeah, and that segment, I watched that segment again recently.
It's embarrassing.
But it's also amazing because it's like, you know, they really were trying to grapple with what the hell you were doing. And, you know.
It was fascinating.
And they were fascinated by the fact that you and several people in your friend group, several people in your friend group at the time had full-time jobs. You know, they're like, but these people are gainfully employed. And
and look what they're doing.
Why are they doing this?
Every punk I knew had a
job
of some kind. There were a lot of people that hung wallpaper and stuff.
So who is this guy anyway? Just another Dallas crazy, you're probably thinking. Well, yes and no.
But I think they were, you know, grappling with what you were talking about. Like, most people don't explore anger and nihilism as a valid emotion because they're interested in it, you know, and they were trying to figure out why. I mean, in a really, you know, local news way, really. Like,
well, yeah, no, I understand. And most people have a little difficulty doing it. But, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you know, you got somebody who's really talented and really crazy, and you can use that positively, we gave him an outlet. We gave him, for the time that we were together, we gave him a positive outlet, and he, for the most part, was on, I'm not going to call it the straight and narrow, but he never missed a rehearsal, he never missed a show, he never was the problem. And the only time it became an issue was after that show at the Theater Gallery in January in 87, when the band took 87 off, that he became an alcoholic. Now, I'd worked with Bobby for years, and Bobby drank beer all the time, but not, there's a difference between someone who just drinks beer here and there, and somebody who is drinking like this from the moment they get up. And and you see that the person that you knew isn't there anymore after a while. And that's what started to happen. When I hadn't had much contact with Bobby in the period before, when we reformed in the beginning of 88 to start playing again and write new material, and I and everybody else was dumbfounded at the change in him. And it became evident pretty quickly. The first time we took him out of town, we took him to Houston, and we were in Houston, and I remember us going out to dinner in my van, most of us, and as when we got back in the van afterwards, we just kind of all looked at each other and said, I don't think we can do this anymore with Bobby. He was too far gone.
Bobby ran over somebody who's in a position to like fucking skank your ass, bitch, slap your hands if you like with anything.
And we continued to play a few shows up until I moved. But the person that I knew, the person that I liked, and the person that I love, and the person that I miss to this day, wasn't there anymore. And so what happened after that, what happened after September 88 with Bobby, was a different person doing it. And it was a person who's all his, he'd lost control of all his worst impulses. And I'll tell you that I knew Candy quite well. And she died years later. Candy had always, she always did drugs as long as I knew her, and I knew her from the early 80s. She and her husband before Bobby were very, very close friends of ours. And they both began to have problems with drugs, and it tore their lives up. You know, sometime around, I'm going to say 87, you know, 86, 87, the cocaine thing went through the country, you know.
Yeah.
And they had kind of just lost control of it, and they lost control of their lives. They split up and everybody went different ways. And it was an extremely sad story. But she got mixed up with Bobby at a later time. And I didn't expect violence. Now, with men, violence was, he was violent all the time. He was never violent in the band, and that was never an issue. He was a pussycat to deal with. But he had a very, very bad reputation for violence before we got together. As a matter of fact, he wasn't allowed in the hot club, which we ended up playing all the time. It was something that should never have happened, and I felt absolutely terrible about what happened with Candy and with Bobby. And Bobby ended up in prison, and then his life went completely down the tubes after that. You know, he eventually went on the streets. I know a couple of people who tried to, you know, they gave him places to stay sometimes, like a trailer besides our house or something. And for a while he was living behind a 7-Eleven. I went looking for him once when I was in Dallas. I couldn't find him. Yeah. But, you know, he finally died of acute liver disease, alcoholism.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd wrecked himself. And all I can say is that for a while, he was relatively happy with the band, I think. It gave him something constructive to do rather than destructive with his life. And it gave him something that he could be proud of. What is it may sound weird to a lot of people, that, oh, why would you be proud of something as crazy as that? Well, I'm real happy with the work that we did.
Yeah,
I'm not a bit ashamed of it.
It's incredible work. And I think like everyone who's like sort of listens to this show, or us in particular, who sort of play in these hobby bands that, you know, probably, you know, like look to Stickman and the Three Guns as like this, you know, something to aspire to and can never achieve it. You know, in part because the sound is impossible to replicate, it seems, but also it's you know, that package of, you know, a person finding meaning in music and Bobby and being able to use it as an outlet, and the rest of you putting it all together in this, like, you know, loud, spectacular package. It's, I mean, it's a difficult thing to talk about for us, and I don't think I did a really good job of it in the end, but it's like this thing with punk and hardcore or spectacular music is that, you know, we kind of want it to be aggressive and confrontational and to have like this sense of danger, and we want performers and entertainers who are authentic, so we're then aggressive and confrontational and frightening, and then the moment the show's over, we want them to be model citizens, and we want to be model citizens, and everyone wants to get along. But, you know, how can you, it's just kind of like poking a bear in some ways when you like want this expectation, and real issue with punk and hardcore, obviously. That brings us to like your new projects or projects over the last 10 years or so. How did you move into doing solo stuff and like I guess more ambient kind of recording.
In 1987, when Stickmen took a break, I had become interested in, I'd become interested in dance music, and I didn't understand it at all. I didn't really like listening to it, but I was interested in it because one night playing in the Ritz in Austin, big theater, old movie theater in Austin, in between sets, they were playing music in the house, and I looked around me and I realized that girls everywhere were dancing to the house music. And I realized that, you know, it struck me as that dancers didn't really care about what it was they were, who and what it was they were listening to, as long as the rhythm and the dance beat thing was there. They could have, I mean, it could have been, you know, almost any kind of melody as long as the whole thing went that way, because that just struck me as maybe what was going on. And so I thought, well, what if you put something together that was really abstract musically, but still fit into this dancing niche? And the problem that I had was that I was completely incapable of describing to anyone else what I was looking for in I needed a dance beat to start with. I needed the drummer to be able to make that. And Scott, Lord love him for his, his drumming. He wasn't really able to envision what I was kind of hearing in my head. I wasn't capable of telling him, and nobody else could figure it out either. And so it ended up, we flailed around for a couple of months, but it ended up being much slower. And I've had a couple of delay units during that period, Stickmen, and I got more and more interested in delay effects. And so I was starting to build sound on sound stuff with these guys trying to do something, but it never went anywhere, and I was completely directionless. And so we stopped doing it after a few months. But when I started playing again, 5 or 10 years ago or whatever it was, I fell back in love with delay and started to add multiple delays. So I've developed a pretty complicated setups over time. I'm changing it all the time, but I got really interested in music that constantly changed, but didn't really follow a clear path, you know, a melody or, some development and resolution or anything like that, but that it just changed in a way like, well, if look at clouds are kind of the same, but they're always changing if you watch them for a while. And if you watch them for a while, you can get kind of hypnotized by it, and you like it. And so I started to get interested in music that you could sort of find yourself floating away.
Thank you.
So I started, you know, piecing some stuff together. I tried hilariously to see if I couldn't put some kind of a band together, but I couldn't begin to describe to anybody what I was thinking about, much less have any place where you could take it. So I ended up taking it out one night in the summer of 2018 by myself, and going and playing in a place called Howl, which is a big tattoo parlor and has a club attached to it. And so they were having like a Thursday night open mic thing. It's a metal place, basically. It's a place where metal kids go. And that's what they have, is metal bands play there, local and from the, from Florida area bands. And they're awful. But the weird thing turned out to be that, so I arranged to go, and I went and actually played. But the weird thing was that what I didn't know is that on the open mic nights, that the crowd that came to that was a completely different crowd. It wasn't young punk or metal kids. It was middle class suburbanites and singer songwriter types. And so I bring this thing in where I have this pedal board that's like 32 inches long. It's this giant pedal board and then a rack next to it. And then I come in and they say, I've got two things, and how long are they? So, well, about 20 minutes each. And then they go, so we go in and start to play, and I thinking I was smart to have my buddy who set my amp up for me lean it back on its legs so that the sound didn't hit the audience in the face, but actually went up towards the ceiling and kind of got over everybody's heads. And it turned out that really made everything very much worse for everybody. But this performance is captured on YouTube, so you can see it on YouTube.
I've seen that video.
Some of it, yeah.
The owner of the club comes up to me like two or three times, where they go, "Can't you turn that damn thing down? We can't hear to take beer orders." It'll be over in a minute. Leave me alone.
some things never change, Clark.
Exactly. When I got off the stage, I said, I've never not been told to turn down. So I'm batting 1,000, So I started doing this, and then I ended up putting out the solo album that I put out last November, I guess a year ago. I don't know whether you have.
Is that Hear Us Through the Hole in Thin Air?
Yeah, Hear Us Through the Hole in Thin Air. And that, I sort of got my William Burroughs largely out of my system on that.
Mr. Bradley, Mr. Martin, Hear Us Through the Hole in Thin Air.
They said it was good talking with you.
Likewise, likewise.
I hope I'm less scary than I could be.
Well, when you first sent that email to us, we were both kind of like, oh shit, it's been really nice that it's come kind of full circle and we've been able to address some of these things.
You asked me before about the legacy and stuff. I've tried to keep Bobby from becoming just a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Because he was a very wonderful, sweet guy most of the time when he was around. So I really tried to help people remember that they're real people involved in this thing. And they weren't all, I mean, just because the show was scary didn't mean we were all scary people, no matter what happened in the long run.
Yeah, and pulling those things apart requires a bit more nuance than, you know.
Yeah, it does. It's not easy to do. But I've been at least trying to keep my hand in the pot about it.
I've got to start work. I'm running late now.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks.
Well, really
thanks
good talking to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this was nice. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks, Clark.
Okay. Take it easy, man.
Cheers. See you soon.
All right. Bye-bye.